partially funded by the Sloan Foundation for Democracy, and that is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based in Taipei, and it is the first national democracy assistance foundation to be established in Asia. So before I introduce our speakers today, I'll just briefly talk about today's topic and why we're covering two such broad issues in one event. This year, our Civil Society and Democracy series theme is Taiwan's Global Impact. So we decided to hold this event in March because it's Women's History Month in the U.S. and because March 8th is International Women's Day. And though gender is distinct from sexual orientation, the two are intertwined, and discussions about one often lead to discussions about the other. And in the context of Taiwan especially, some very public milestones were achieved in the last few years, so it just made sense to hold this discussion at once on the two topics. And those historic milestones, if you don't already know, are in 2016, President Tsai Ing-wen was the first woman to be elected as president in Taiwan, and she then appointed Audrey Tang, who became the first transgender official in the executive branch of the government. And then in 2017, the Constitutional Court of Taiwan ruled that it is not constitutional to stipulate that marriage is strictly between a man and a woman, though the legislative branch has yet to pass the Marriage Equality Act. So these very public achievements, though, lead one to question how much do women and members of the LGBT community experience equality or discrimination in their daily lives in Taiwan society and politics. And so for that reason, we have our two guest speakers here. And I will introduce them and then hand it off to them. So Dr. Shiling Huang is a professor in sociology and gender studies at the National Defense Medical Center in Taipei. Dr. Huang is a feminist activist, former director of the Taiwanese Feminist Scholars Association, and has advised Taiwan's government to develop strategies for gender mainstreaming. She was also a member of the Anti-Human Trafficking Coordination / Supervisory Council in the Executive Yuan. She is presently the chairperson of the Taipei Women's Rescue Foundation and a representative of civil society organization on the supervisory board of Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. She also serves as a member of the Presidential Office's Gender Equality Committee and Taipei City Commission on the Promotion of Women's Rights. Her past research examined sexuality, prostitution, masculinities, family violence, and Aboriginal women in Taiwan. Dr. Huang has several publications in Mandarin on various gender issues, and her latest book was published in 2017, titled Gender Mainstreaming, Taiwan's Experiences and International Comparison. She has a master's degree in social work and a PhD in social welfare from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Dr. Chloe Schwenke, to her left, is a professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and recently completed a year-long contract as the director of the Global Program on Violence, Rights, and Inclusion at the International Center for Research on Women. In the past, she has served as vice president of Freedom House, a senior political appointment at USAID under the Obama administration, and has worked extensively in Africa on development. Dr. Schwenke also serves on the board of International Development Ethics Association and the advisory board of World Learning, and previously was on the board of the Society for International Development, Washington, D.C. chapter. Dr. Schwenke is currently awaiting publication on several chapters in Educational Resources, and her forthcoming memoir titled Self-ish, A Transgender Awakening will be published in May by Red Hen Press, so please look out for that. And with that, I will pass it on to Dr. Huang.
Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you, Melissa's introduction. Thank you, Global Taiwan Institute, for inviting me. I'm very honored to have this opportunity to discuss with you about gender equality and state feminism in Taiwan.
As you may be aware that as a young democracy, Taiwan nevertheless went from holding the first ever presidential election in 1996 to electing his first woman president, Tsai Ing-wen, in 2016. But actually, we have had six female vice president candidates in five out of the six elections so far, with Li Shuolin, Li Shuolin was elected. <I'll try. laughs> Li Shulian, let's see, sorry, okay, that's she. Being elected in 2000 and 2004, and none of these six female politicians come from well-connected political families. The contrast sharply with female political leaders from other Asian countries. And first, Thai was elected chairperson of her party solely on merit, because she was just better than her male peers. And Wang Jingfeng, that's she, and this is Wang Luxuan. They both were recruited into civil service as leaders of women's movement and later earned nomination also on account of their outstanding performance. These six female politicians reflect rapid progress in women's political empowerment in Taiwan. I think has a direct relationship with our democracy and women's movement.
Sorry, I try to get familiar with the technique. Which one? What? today's presentation, I will first suggest mother's one, my online. Okay. I will first suggest some main reasons for the rapid growth of female political influence. Then I hope to shed light on something perhaps not so well known in the international community, namely state feminism in Taiwan. Finally, I will point out several challenges remain ahead to achieving the goal of branding Taiwan on gender equality. Let me start by giving you some background about Taiwan's gender equality based on two global indices. I must first stress that not being recognized by UN as a autonomous country does mean that we now officially rank in these indices. This ranking is by an estimation by Taiwan's government. The two indices both consider both areas of gap between men and women in their participation and attainment in economy, education, health, and politics. With respect to 2015 Gender Inequality Index, Taiwan could have been placed 9th out of 159 countries. And in the 2012 index, Taiwan was number 2, could have outranked even Scandinavia countries. There's another index. 2016 Gender Gap Index, Taiwan could outrank the US, Australia in 38th place, far ahead of other Asian countries. If we estimate the gender gap index in detail, you will see that Taiwan's position was held mainly by high school in women's political empowerment. There are three indicators for political empowerment. Tsai's election certainly helped improve Taiwan's score in the indicator of years with female head of state, but equally outstanding was score in numbers of women in parliament, as the figure in Taiwan is about 40%, again far ahead of USA and other Asia countries. But the third indicator of women's political empowerment is the number of women in ministerial position. There's much room for improvement. When Tsai just came into office, only one, that is 4 out of
40 ministerial positions were occupied by women. Not only is this figure below the one-third promised by her campaign, it is even worse than the 25% under the two previous male presidents. So you can imagine, no wonder a women's rights group would strongly protest. That's what I said. We will not give Chai a honeymoon period after her inauguration because of her disappointing performance so far. And this led Chai Ing-wen to apologize right away on social media and plead to truly realize gender mainstreaming in every field of our government's policy. Let me elaborate further some major reasons behind the rapid growth of women's political influence in Taiwan. First, as mentioned before, earlier, I think women have just performed brilliantly in politics. And second, in 2005, the parliamentary electorate system was officially changed to a single district, two votes system. And the number of elected female members on each party's list, legislator at large seats, should not be less than one half of the total number. So because of we have this quota system, so the percentage of female legislators was very sharply increased to 38% in 2016. Another reason, because civil society has great power in Taiwan, with women's groups, one of the most active branches. So the major political parties, BPT and KMT, they just competed to support women movement's cause and gender equality issues. And in each election, the DPP has asked women's group to recommend legislator at large candidates. And right now, there's four have recently been elected to who were leaders of women's groups. And KMT also reserved candidates for women immigrants and representative of children welfare groups. Also, the president of both parties have also included the recommendation by women's group in their nomination of grand justice and members of examination yuan and control yuan. If I have time, I will talk more about these pictures. Now let me get into another point I'd like to emphasize. Yes, I think women's movement being a very key force driving gender equality in Taiwan, but our history, women's movement history, only very short, only 30 years. Feminist endeavor can be distinguished into three phases in terms of their relationship with the state. In the first phase, women still mostly kept their distance from political parties. The pivotal movement came in 1995 when Chen Shui-bian, that is former president Chen Shui-bian, was elected a Taipei City mayor, and he accepted the suggestion of leading feminists to create the Taipei City Commission on the Promotion of Women's Rights. With this mechanism, many new policies on women's rights were implemented in Taiwan. And the third phase, the institutionalization of state feminism, moved into full swing, with Chen Shui-bian again a key player. Upon becoming the president in 2000, Chen Shui-bian charged the cabinet with creating a central government equivalent of the Taipei City Commission, and soon similar committees were set up in every county and municipal governments. So what is state feminism? I don't know if there's one in USA. Well, it really depends your definition. I will just give a very simple definition. Institutionalize feminist policy scope. That is my definition of feminism. And I once, now let me get into another point I'd like to emphasize. I once women activists use for strategy to promote their feminism, the establishment of gender equality policy mechanism, the implementation of gender mainstreaming and CEDAW, the promotion of a quota system, and the enactment of dedicated law on gender equality. This graph shows that the structure of gender equality policy mechanism in Taiwan, which we can describe as a hub spoke model, borrowing the term used for the Australian equivalent, except in Taiwan it is more comprehensive. In the hubs exist throughout central and local governments. The central government hub here is called Gender Equality Committee. We changed the name to Gender Equality Committee. It is convened by the Premier of Cabinet, of the Premier of the Executive Yuan, with 16 ministers and 17 civil representatives as members, and staffed by a Department of Gender Equality within the Executive Yuan. Also, the spokes are six interdependent groups promoting related policy in various areas, and the individual committee for gender equality also within each ministry. I want to show this picture to you as an indicator of the strength of the state feminism in Taiwan. On the recent International Women's Day, I think you saw the news, feminist leaders around the world were on street demonstrating. But we, Taiwanese feminists, were here. Let's see, here. They were here. What are they doing? They're negotiating and or arguing with government officials in a gender equality committee, and also attended a ceremony in which, this is our prime premier right now, in the middle of this guy. In a meeting also, the premier commended departments that have performed well in gender equality policy task. I'm going to the second strategies used by women's group in gender equality committee. First, they're using the importance of keeping established international trend as reasoning. They urge the government to enact CEDAW and put gender mainstreaming into practice. As a result, CEDAW and gender mainstreaming work is required for all major policy and regulation across all domains. And this is not only in central government, all the local government are doing this too. President Tsai often used gender mainstreaming to indicate the government's support for gender equality. There's a case recently, a judge ruled that his colleague involved in sexual harassment was not guilty. So this case caused a huge mass protest. So President Tsai responded to it on Facebook by saying that the judiciary must work on gender mainstreaming and improve gender equality education for our judges and judicial officers. Another strategy used by women's movement is one-third quota system. Starting in 2005, with more than 500 task implementation committees in central government departments, so that's really succeed. And now all this task force, they just have to obey this principle of one-third quota system. And more recently, feminist leader began to target organization from political parties to state-run business and private enterprises, as well as the cabinet. It is hoped that eventually the quota can be raised to 40%, even 50%, although I think the goal remains some way off. We still have a long way to go. But you can see that member of examination yen and member of control yen are women doing pretty well. It's already more than 50%. And another strategy to promote state feminists is dedicated role to guarantee the rights of women and LGBT persons. I'll give two examples. One is the gender equality in employment law. The other is gender equity education aid. Both acts stipulated that educational institution and organization of 30 people and above should establish measures to prevent sexual harassment and sexual assault, to process complaints, and to penalize offenses. So at the time, by making it illegal to discriminate against LGBT persons, these two acts have engendered a general attitude of acceptance of LGBT people among young generation. In particular, central and local educational authorities are required to form participatory democratic committees for the promotion of textbook and learning environments that are gender equal and LGBT friendly. But I'd like to point out this kind of mechanism also has shortage problems. In recent years, anti-LGBT groups have tried to gain a foothold in the committee to subvert the regulations. So that is the problem of state feminism, one of the problems. If I have time, I will get into that more, but I have to go down to this. I want to point out that state feminism promoted many gender equality policy in Taiwan, but the pace of change in gender equality is slow in many areas, such as high education, labor participation rate, number of female managers and women in science, technology, and engineering. Taiwan lags far behind Scandinavia countries. And President Chai, in one of her speeches, singled out women's participation in the workplace as a priority of the country and pinpointed to childcare and elderly care as areas where the government could do more to help women overcome the difficulty of wage gap and work-life balance. Come to my conclusion, I would say that Taiwanese government is aware of gender equality as the country's soft power. So in the speech I just quoted, President Chai claimed that her basic experience in promoting gender equality can benefit the global gender equality movement. But I have to say that Chai, President Chai, or other politicians never declare themselves feminist. I think this is important because feminism provides theories of gender equality and also practical policy direction. A politician who claims to be a feminist means that she or he understands the cause of gender inequality and the relevance of gender equality to human rights, democracy, and national competitiveness. So I think perhaps one day, when we have equal male and female members becomes the norm in our cabinet, as in Scandinavian countries, in France, in Canada, and also if our president can emulate the Prime Minister of Sweden to proclaim our government a feminist government, or proudly declare herself or himself like Justin Trudeau of Canada. So when that day comes, when branding Taiwan on gender equality will be a reality, then Taiwan will have produced his third miracle and can truly consider itself an example of for the international community. That's it. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Thank you for that talk. I think it sets a really important context for what I'm talking about too, because equality does not only apply to gender. It applies to human beings and human dignity at large. I want to make a self-declaration before I start, and that is that I've never been to Taiwan. I've worked extensively in Indonesia and the Philippines and Thailand on LGBTQ issues, but I'm looking forward to my visit to Taiwan at some point, and I'm well networked with key activists in Taiwan who have been helpful to me in preparing for this talk to you today. So if you ask me in-depth questions about Taiwan, I will come and look at these two ladies here to help me out. But that being said, I'm delighted to have you here and I'm really interested in this topic. I also, just to get a few things out of the way, not all people are comfortable talking about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer issues, which that acronym stands for. That's the way it is. I mean, this is a community. It's a community that not all people can relate to. Some people may have questions about that. This is a safe space in which to ask those questions. There's no such thing as a dumb question. So this is a chance to hopefully expand your horizons a little bit about what human dignity means when you're looking at all people, including those who are often the most excluded. I'm going to start with this image because it's such a positive image. Taiwan has the largest pride event in all of Asia. And this last year was over 110,000 people. Now that's significant not only for Taiwan as a country, but a significant proportion of the people that came to this event, that participated in this event, came from all over Asia. All over Asia and countries that really do not have anything like the levels of equality that are experienced by LGBTQ people in Taiwan. Taiwan is really a real leader in this space right now amongst all Asian nations. It's been a hard-fought battle to get there, but they are there now, particularly with lesbian and gay issues. Not quite so much with transgender issues, which I'll talk about in a minute. But certainly on lesbian and gay issues, issues of same-sex marriage, for instance, issues of basically gender equality across gender identity in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity, which are well-established and I think at this stage inevitable in terms of being inculcated, embraced by the culture. It doesn't mean that there's a monolithic support for LGBTQ rights. It's very generational. There is pushback, and I'll talk about that too when we get there. But these are uplift for somebody like me who's in this community. These are really important images because this is the community standing proud for itself. While Taiwan's been a leader in the space of LGBTQ human rights, it's not participated internationally very much in engagement with other civil society groups, even with other governments in this context. In fact, most of the research and work that I've been involved with has very clearly left Taiwan out. And I hope that's something that can change, given the strong leadership that Taiwan has shown in this space so far. But the United Nations, for instance, has worked very closely on setting up a study across all the rest of Asia to look at the state of LGBTQ issues. And sometimes you'll see the initial LGBTI, where I stands for intersex. We can talk about that too if we have time. But these quotes, and I'm not going to read it out loud, but it's just basically giving you an oversight of an overview of the plight of sexual minorities and gender minorities across Asia, and it's not a pretty picture. There's still significant discrimination against these groups, deep cultural values that make it hard for people who identify as members of this group to essentially get on in their societies, to have real opportunities for employment, for participation, for even being treated civilly in many cases. Being able to access public services, etc., it's really hard. Some countries enjoy an inflated view of their progress, like Thailand, where in fact the cultural traditions in Thailand are so rigorous and entrenched in a heterosexual model and a gender binary model that it's, you know, although they're individuals that seem to have a great deal of freedom in this community, there's an awful lot of work to be done in countries like Thailand. Indonesia's going in the opposite direction. The Philippines is somewhere in the middle, where you have issues of the very large influence of the church there, which is controversial and challenging for this community to be able to get established as respected members of society. So we're looking at a situation around Asia that makes Taiwan remarkably good. And yet I would argue that Taiwan has a very important role to rise to be a leader for the region and not just for itself. That's a challenge I'd like to carry forward today. There's been a lot of programming work done by the United Nations and the Swedish government and USAID and others around helping to empower LGBTQ groups, LGBTI groups, throughout the Asian countries, again, not including Taiwan. This is mostly working with civil society groups to help them learn basic skills of organization, advocacy, promotion of human rights, reporting of human rights abuses, education, public education, getting people to understand what gender and sexual minorities are about. A lot of just basic human rights 101 education. This has really been important too. And what they found in this programmatic work, which is still ongoing, is a huge variation across Asia in terms of competence and ability within civil society. So this is a really important chance to link these countries together, really engage activists across national boundaries and build strength regionally, which again I hope that Taiwan can become a part of soon. There's also a specific program being done for transgender and their identity issues. A big report came out just last year by the UN and USA looking at particularly access to health and HIV issues, but also governance issues, how governments treat issues of gender identity. Again, we'll talk about this more specifically in the context of Taiwan, but the issues around gender identity are probably 20 to 30 years behind issues of same-sex relationships and rights attached to people who are in those kinds of relationships or identify in that context. We have a long, long way to go with gender identity, as we do in this country, as we did in the paper yesterday. Still fighting that fight really hard and strong. The biggest challenge, and it certainly applies all over, is the recognition of a person's identity to be what they say it is. And for many people, it's been very hard to get identity documents changed. That means when they show up for a job, their identity documents show them as being of one gender and their presentation shows them as being something quite different. They don't get the job. When they show up to go to university, when they show up to get an airline ticket, when they show up to do pretty much any engagement in society, it's frustrating because their identity documents do not align with their presentation. And in most countries in Asia, and it's getting better in Taiwan now, but in most countries in Asia, it's not possible to change your gender documents. Taiwan it is now. But that's been recently. But let's look at Taiwan and see where we're starting. First of all, for gay and lesbian activists, their activism started in the 80s. And in that time period, people were getting arrested for being gay. By the way, gay means lesbian or bisexual or gay in the sense of male. Gay members, homosexuals. It does not, by default, mean transgender. Although you often find gay being used for everyone, many transgender people do not identify as gay. So that's a little sort of bit of terminology that's important to get right from the start. The 80s saw many gay activists, lesbian activists, bisexual activists in those days, but lesbian and gay people in Taiwan getting arrested simply for being out. It wasn't legal. That changed significantly after the millennium, 2000, and there was significant progress made, but not in all regards. And I'm putting up just again, looking at the transgender issue, how much that's behind others. There was the first transgender activist in Taiwan, Tsai Ya-ting, who tried very hard and very strong to get her identity documents recognized. She pursued that as strongly as she could, just simply getting her photograph changed. That was denied in 2002. 2003, things were cohering though. You see, with especially the gay and lesbian community, the very first gay pride, which is, the, you know, although it's hard for people outside the community to understand the significance of pride, Pride is really a chance to be out in public in a very strong community way. To say, we're here, we're not going away, we matter, we want to participate. But it's also a celebration. It's a chance for gay and lesbian people and now trans people to get away from being the other, get away from being the small group that's discriminated against, and actually feel their presence energetically in a way that the community is celebrating. Another really important thing that happened in 2003 was that the country of Taiwan started to look at how to address education around issues, not just the gender equality, but certainly lesbian and gay issues, and then on trans issues, and start to build that into the curriculum, initially informally and later formally. That's borne enormous fruits in subsequent years because young people that are now coming into active positions in government, in civil society, in the private sector, are very comfortable in Taiwan with these issues. They're well educated on these issues. They're not offended or outraged by these issues. They've been educated by them. But as I said, trans issues linger behind. And in 2003, Tsai Ya-ting, who I will talk about more later, committed suicide. And that's not an uncommon outcome for trans people. In this country, and a few countries where we have data, the rate of attempted suicide for transgender people is nearly 10 times as high as the general population. It's a really tough thing to deal with in a society that's this excluding in this country and imagine around the world. You have to deal with that. The other ones I'm not going to read out to you, they're there, you can read it yourself. There is significant progress. May 2010 was huge because the curriculum really built in LGBTQ awareness into the educational curriculum. In the context of human rights, 2013 we started to finally see some data. My background is research, so data is really precious to me. We started to see some changes in terms of how people thought about these issues, and these are significant numbers. We start seeing more than half the population supporting same-sex marriage. That's stunning. That's a really big accomplishment. And 76%, three-quarters of the population, far higher than here, supporting equal treatment for gays and lesbians. Again, not trans. Transgender people not really factoring into this at this stage. Earlier, the government in Taiwan had allowed transgender people to transition officially from one gender to another, but they required that they undergo gender-confirming surgeries to do that. That has two problems. There's a good number of transgender people do not feel the necessity to have such surgeries, and there's also many transgender people who can't possibly afford this. These are very expensive surgeries. So people who were not able to have those surgeries were prohibited having their genders recognized in a sense of authentic identity. That changed in 2015, and that's in line with countries around the world now, progressive countries. conversion therapy, which is, you know, the state or society trying to, being some sort of intervention to get people to sort of come back to what they call as normal. It doesn't work. It's a denial of people's diversity, and it's been largely debunked everywhere. I mean, it's finally in 2016 debunked in Taiwan as well. This is not slowing down. You see, in 2017, was last year, the marriage equality law was passed in the sense that the courts say this needs to be done by next May, or else it will automatically become law. They have a chance to actually take a proactive step and create a law in the meantime. But the courts have ruled that gender equality in marriage is set in terms of your gender. It doesn't matter what sex you are. This is a really important thing that working on marriage equality. With this progress, though, and this is not just in Taiwan, we're seeing this around the world, specifically in the last year and a half, increasing levels of pushback. And even though in Taiwan the population of Christians is only 6%, the most significant pushback is coming from the Christian churches, particularly the evangelical churches of Taiwan, pushing back very strongly with a lot of money, trying to discourage people from supporting LGBTQ equality. And this is a concern for a lot of people, particularly with the budgets that they have accessible to them. The source of that money is not clear, but it's a model picking up this trend elsewhere in the world. A lot of that money comes from right here. So that's something we're sort of looking at. The president, although she gave some very promising messages during her campaign to support LGBTQ people, she's really not come through. And a lot of the activists I'm in touch with there are really disappointed that she hasn't taken a lot stronger action to support equality for human and for diversity across the whole spectrum. She's really not done much to do that. And again, transgender being this way behind. There's really no structural mechanisms in place to support transgender people. Many of the key support professions like social work, psychology, etc., the ones that need to support people through those transitions, are not being trained in these fields. It's actually still very hard for transgender people to get the support they need to successfully transition gender in Taiwan. And the government so far has not been stepping up to that very much at all. We both, my previous speaker and I, have been throwing lots of numbers at you and graphs and all of that. I think it's every so often important to go back to an individual. And Tsai Ya-ting is somebody that was an inspiration to me. I mean, my disclosure, I am a transgender woman, and long before I transitioned, I was hearing about Tsai Ya-ting, even in this country, because she was so courageous and so brave at a time when it was really hard for me to be in Taiwan. So civil society groups who were active in the transgender space were deeply moved by her example, her courage, her bravery, her clinging tight to her authentic gender identity. But she was so isolated and had so little support, and the manner in which she committed suicide was so poignant. She basically threw off her clothes and threw away her male body in front of a train. And she made it very clear to activists that that's the way she was going to live her life, because she could not bear another day in that life. So this is, you know, a sensibility shared by many trans people who have no hope of successfully being acknowledged and recognized in their gender identity as they know it to be. Transgender people take extraordinary risks to claim that right within themselves. And sometimes, without the support that you need, it's simply too much. And here's an activist who had just, you know, lost her critical case to get her photograph accepted on her ID. Not asking for very much. She wasn't asking for an interview change, just her photograph. And even that was not okay. So, although she left a legacy with her NGO, the Kiki Butterfly Garden, that lived on, in fact, that group sat with her father. And they were negotiating how the burial should be for 2 days, because he was a very simple, poor farmer, didn't really know what his daughter was all about, and was able to persuade him to let her real name, Tsai Ya-ting, her feminine name, be included on the side of her burial urn, and that she be allowed to be buried in her funeral clothes. It was amazing. She was covered with a burial blanket so that the family members didn't actually need to see that, but the community knew that she was at least being honored and offered to see that. So, you know, these are small accomplishments, but these are real human stories that go on. One of our biggest challenges in Taiwan right now is there's very little data being collected. There's just, and that was my experience at ICRW when I worked there. Around the world, people are not funding the collection of data on LGBTQ issues, and particularly on the T, on transgender issues. They don't have data. We have lots of anecdotal stories, and those are pretty harrowing in most cases. And those stories tell us a lot, but they don't allow significant funds to be spent in ways that results can be measured. And for that, you need a empirical baseline, you need data. Nobody's paying for that right now. So a lot of the key development that needs to be done in the LGBT space is not getting done because we don't have those baselines. We don't have that data. But the anecdotal evidence remains strong. We see, particularly in very patriarchal countries, the tolerance for LGBTQ is very low. It remains low, particularly among older generations and particularly among men. We're seeing extremely high unemployment levels, which is the same in this country, by the way, for trans people, particularly during their transition. Almost impossible to get a job during that stage of your life. Taiwan still has no known full-time transgender activists, which, you know, is remarkable since they had decided back in 2002. No one right now is able to sustain themselves financially in full-time activism, which says something about the financial support levels that are in Taiwan for this community right now. We also, of course, have transgender men. People don't talk about transgender men very much. There's as many transgender men as there are transgender women. But transgender men simply blend into the society, and they do this all around the world. They're far less inclined to take political stance because they don't have to. It's so easy for men who are transgender to essentially be absorbed, it's called going self. Once you start on testosterone, your voice drops, your facial hair, you just are a short guy. And people accept you right away as male, they don't ask any questions. It's far more scandalous in our cultural norms around the world, not just in Taiwan, for a man, quote unquote, to become a woman. It's like, why would anybody ever do that? And of course, we have many issues, as we all know, around women and sexuality and the objectification of women. It all builds into the fact that we are focused so much more on transgender women than on transgender men. We do also have an interesting development in Taiwan right now. This discussion has just started on creating a third gender category, used for passports and key documents. Third gender is not the same as transgender. You know, some transgender people are very comfortable identifying outside of the binary, male or female. We call these people genderqueer. There's other titles that people will use for that. It's a tough place to live androgynously in between gender designations. Society really isn't ready for that right now. In a country like Taiwan, where the clothing, the attire standards, clothing standards are so gendered right now, it's really hard for people to take that androgynous space in between. But there's a recognition that this is where people sometimes place themselves. They simply do not feel either male or female. They simply feel themselves, and they want to define themselves outside that binary. And Taiwan is starting to make space for that right now. That's really impressive. Development for them and says a lot about understanding gender identity and diversity, which is really important. We did hear earlier that you guys in Taiwan have a remarkable accomplishment in having the first minister level person in all of Asia as a transgender person, Audrey Tang. Audrey Tang is known probably much more for her expertise in software and computer work than she is for being a transgender woman. And fair enough, she doesn't have to be an advocate for transgender issues, although many people wish that she could have done a little bit more in that regard. But she's living her life, she's an effective minister, she's brilliant. Just by being that role model, somebody getting on with her life, is really important for the trans community. So just having her there is really important. Last but not least, is I'm just turning it back to Ban Ki-moon, and even the Secretary General of Scholar has been committed to the idea of diversity is something that we not only tolerate, it's something we celebrate, that we don't simply exclude certain people and leave them behind because it's inconvenient and uncomfortable. People like me make a lot of people uncomfortable, and I can't help that. I am what I am, and transgender people are who we are, and we are putting it all in the line to say we're here, we're not going away. We demand, and that's the right word, that we be treated civilly and with respect and with dignity, and same with trans people, LGBTQ people in Taiwan. I think there's so much to commend the government and people of Taiwan for in this space. My only sort of push would be that we bring up the trans community as well.
So I'm just going to ask one question for both panelists before we open it up to the Q&A, and I know it's almost 1 o'clock and some people need to run, so totally understand. But for both of you, just a kind of broad question, why do you think it matters that Taiwan, a small country, and some even argue not even a country, why does it matter that Taiwan has made the progress that it's made or is fighting for these rights internationally? And how can it continue to lead or contribute internationally when it is excluded from these international spaces? Either one of you would like to start. Yeah.
Happy to jump in.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, just really to go back to that same model of larger time, just simply being there to model this kind of thing, to model these norms. And the acceptability of, in this case, LGBT person, but also gender equality, the standards of which is getting closer to where it was, genuine equality, genuine inclusion, that's a remarkable model. I think the challenge is not so much a model of the government of Taiwan, but having to be out there and engage foreign countries, which we know is already hard because of the Taiwan status. The challenge is getting civil society in Taiwan to engage much more broadly. Taiwan's got so much to offer to civil society. Examples of what has happened in but I think many of the activists I know in Asia are looking for participation, looking for response, looking for robust.
I thank you. I still wish that the United Nations can recognize Taiwan, and we can do much, much, much more. And because it's really difficult for our government to try to contribute to the international community that Taiwan, we are quite far away, quite far ahead in terms of gender equality and also the LGBT rights. I think the government really encouraged civil society groups to join and to explore opportunity. But a lot of NGOs organization is still under UN system, and it's really difficult. Yeah. And another problem is, I think it's the language problem. Yeah. If people speak Mandarin, all over the world speak Mandarin, and also our academic. Our academic people are not a very big population, and so that's why you cannot read like a state feminism in Taiwan or a lot of women's movements achievements in Taiwan is because we publish articles research in Chinese. Then you don't have time to publish that in English. So I think that is also one of the reasons. But I wish, I hope that, but this is really, China's issue, China's problem that
they don't allow Taiwan to become a member of the international world. And if that changes, then I think we can make a lot of contribution.
Thank you so much. So we have some time for questions from the audience. Does anyone have any questions? And please state your name and your affiliation before your question.
Thank you. I'm Richard Coleman. I'm retired federal government worker. There are a couple around here. I'd like to ask Dr. Schweigert, as an extremely uneducated on the issue of transgender representative, what I've read is that there was a rather high percentage, surprisingly high percentage, of assignment mistakes by doctors when children are born and they're ambiguous equipment from the, on the babies. And it seems that would explain some, but the other issues, and I think you must have thought a great deal about, you know, what goes into the transsexual psychology. What is your thought about why we have transsexuals, or is it as meaningless a question as why are some people gay?
Thank you for the question. I think, you know, one of the things that I really didn't have time to get into in depth is the fact that intersex people are not the same as transgender. The intersex phenomenon is somebody is born with ambiguous, you know, physical manifestations of the sex. Undeveloped manifestations physically of what gender would be assigned. And what happens in those cases is the baby is not clearly male or female. The parents freak out and they rush the babies off to be corrected and fixed. And these intersex babies are often taken to doctors who have no experience in this kind of surgery. And that's where so many of these really terrible damage is done. So often these kinds of surgeries destroy any sexual sensation wherever their lives are damaged so badly. What intersex people are advocating for around the world now is to just leave them alone, accept their bodies work just fine. Let them decide when they're 18 years of age or older if they want to have any sort of plastic surgery to go to one side or the other of the gender spectrum in a physiological sense. That's not, you know, an issue for somebody else to lean on if they don't have that choice for themselves. Transgender people are people that are recognizing that their core identity is not what was assigned to them at birth. And it is not in alignment with the biological manifestation of their body. People who have been socialized, like I was socialized in a Marine Corps family to grow up to be a boy at the ages as early as 5 years old, I knew it was wrong. And this happens so frequently in transgender people at a very early age. They are poignantly aware that people are calling them as this particular gender identity. It's not right. There's something fundamentally wrong. It makes itself clear in many, many different ways. Way too complicated to even talk about it here. But when you think about how much of society and the world is about is trying to tell people like me that I'm wrong, and then people like me are so tenacious and saying that I'm right, that I am a woman, that there's something there. And we persist, and now that there's support and the technology is the counseling, gender conforming surgeries, all that's available, we can completely transition to the full and meaningful life and know ourselves to be. And in so doing, escape years of deep depression and dysfunction, become incredibly happy people at peace, people that have lived very successful lives, or simply being able to realize who you are.
Mike Pasetic, you did in your previous answer address some of my question about the extent to which Taiwan's diplomatic isolation prevents it from playing more of a leading role than perhaps it might otherwise. But certainly in the previous KMT government, maybe it's slacked off a bit now, there was a lot of interchange between China, mainland China, and Taiwan. Taiwan, tons of visitors, back and forth, business and all that. Is there any evidence, anecdotal or otherwise, that the Chinese attitudes were affected by this? Because my impression of China on these issues is they just sort of pretend it doesn't exist and sort of ignore what's going on. And they aren't pro and they aren't actively anti.
I can just answer from my limited knowledge. In China, in the last few years, crackdowns on the LGBTQ community and specifically on feminists has been quite bad, actually. A few years ago, a number of young feminists were jailed. And I'm not a China expert. I can't give you all the dates right now, but it was pretty well known. And I don't know about, from cross-strait exchanges, how it's changed China's or people in China's perception, but I do know that when Taiwan first passed, or when the Constitutional Court passed that the law saying that allowing for the Marriage Equality Act to come into fruition eventually, that people were trying to claim that it was in China because Taiwan's technically part of China. And that was quite funny because that would never happen in the PRC at this moment. So I think that China definitely is on the offense when these very public things happen in Taiwan that are progressive. And they're definitely trying to shield their public from that information and try to limit their populace's ability to be active. So that's my knowledge. I don't know if others have anything to add. And I think this will be, maybe we can take two questions, and those will be our last two. So
thank you for this wonderful discussion. Dr. Schwenke, you mentioned that the reason that Taiwan went forward with this particular topic, one of the reasons was because of the educating the people. Did you mean that literally, or in the schools, or I didn't understand that.
Sure. Yes, I didn't mean quite literally. This was built into the curriculum at a very early age. The curriculum was basically built to address gender equality. But as a component of gender equality, diversity was included, including sexual and gender minorities. So it was put in that context of the whole growth of trying to get young people to think about gender equality and what it's particularly, and looking at diversity issues as well.
A lot of the pushback
right now is coming from newspapers and want to take that color.
We have one last question in the corner.
My name is Abby Bard. I'm with the Center for American Progress, and I was wondering, Dr. Huang, I really appreciated your outlining of the legal structures that exist to support feminism in Taiwan. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about social pressures that also might be impinging on gender equality.
It's a difficult question to answer. Still, feminism is more influential in terms of changing bureaucratic system. This gender mainstreaming's function is really try to change the government's thinking and policy. But in terms of change people's mentality and in terms of change, there's still some patriarchal culture down there. We need more research. But I have to tell is that gender dimension, there's several dimensions. So one dimension may be go faster. Other dimension may be still lag behind. Give an example. Do you know that Taiwan has the lowest birth rate in the world? Yeah. Young people don't want to have kids. They don't even want to get married. So now it's a huge issue for us. We have very high proportion of men and women who do not
who still not married in their late 30s and early 40s. So our traditional culture is that everybody has to get married. The single, being single is stigmatized. But now there's no this issue now. So it really depends on what dimension of the gender equality you mentioned about. Something is really changed very quickly, like the gay issues. I think it's I also mentioned that we have this Gender Equality Education Act that was passed in 2004, so already 20 years already. And that law, I think I just mentioned that all the school from primary school through college, university, they have to set up a committee. We call it Gender Equity Committee. What do this committee do? They have to promotion of textbook and learning environment that are gender equal and LGBT friendly. So I think that really has some function. Make the young generation, they just have this attitude of acceptance of, I think, gay people, but I'm not sure about transgender people. Yeah, but gay and lesbians, like my students, maybe 10 years ago, they still have like 70 and 30%. 30% still kind of feel, it's not a good thing. But now it's maybe 98% of my students. They don't say, that is their rights. Gay and lesbian is their rights. It's our business.
Thank you so much to both our panelists and those of you who remain to ask questions. Please. Thank you. Join me in the round of applause.